8th grade history, United States history, March 30th through April 3rd. Wednesday, April 1st. History unit. Unity and sectionalism in the United States after the War of 1812. Lesson 3. Arguments for and against the Missouri Compromise. Unit overview. Unity and sectionalism in the United States after the War of 1812. Objective. Be able to do this by the end of this lesson. Explain the Missouri Compromise through the eyes of John Quincy Adams. Introduction to Lesson 3. In reviewing the causes, effects, and motivations behind the Missouri Compromise of 1820, we will be looking at the Missouri Compromise through a diary entry from John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, is the Secretary of State under President James Monroe. As the Missouri Compromise was being discussed, John Quincy Adams recorded his experience and conversations with several gentlemen. What you will be doing is reading through his diary entry closely, seeing if you can find the major arguments that either support or do not support the Missouri Compromise. This primary source will be split up into particular sections, and then tomorrow you will answer key discussion questions about the text itself. I will first present to you the primary source as a whole. What details do you see? Plan of action. Review the President and his Cabinet. Read Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution and answer the question. A. In primary source, John Quincy Adams' diary entries, he speaks of the persons in bold. Read through primary source with a special eye towards the details. What details or clues do you see in this text? Who makes what argument and why? John Quincy Adams, the slaveholders, and John C. Calhoun. President and his Cabinet during the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The President of the United States is James Monroe. The Vice President is Daniel D. Tompkins. The Secretary of State is John Quincy Adams. The Secretary of the Treasury is William H. Crawford. The Secretary of War is John C. Calhoun. The Attorney General is William Wirt. The Secretary of the Navy is Smith Thompson. In the primary source, John Quincy Adams' diary entries, look out for when John Quincy Adams writes about these particular figures. Page 11. Read through primary source John Quincy Adams' diary entries with a special eye towards the details. What details or clues do you see in this text? This is from John Quincy Adams' diary entries of March 3rd and March 4th, 1820. The following are excerpts from a book called Memoirs of John Quincy Adams. It was collected and published by Charles Francis Adams, who was John Quincy Adams' son and John Adams' grandson. A. March 3rd. And so it is that a law for perpetuating slavery in Missouri, and perhaps in North America, has been smuggled through both houses of Congress. I have been convinced from the first starting of this question that it could not end otherwise. The fault is in the Constitution of the United States, which has sanctioned a dishonorable compromise with slavery. There is henceforth no remedy for it but a new organization of the Union, to effect which a concert of all the white states is indispensable. Whether that can ever be accomplished is doubtful. It is a contemplation not very creditable to human nature that the cement of common interest produced by slavery is stronger and more solid than that of unmingled freedom. In this instance, the slave states have clung together in one unbroken phalanx, and have been victorious by the means of accomplices and deserters from the ranks of freedom. B. When I came this day to my office, I found there a note requesting me to call at 1 o'clock at the president's house. It was then 1, and I immediately went over. He expected that the 2 bills, for the admission of Maine and to enable Missouri to make a constitution, would have been brought to him for his signature, and he had summoned all the members of the administration to ask their opinions in writing, to be deposited in the Department of State, upon 2 questions. 1, whether Congress had a constitutional right to prohibit slavery in a territory, and 2, whether the 8th section of the Missouri Bill, which interdicts or prohibits slavery forever in the territory north of 36.5 latitude, was applicable only to the territorial state or could extend to it after it should become a state. C. As to the first question, it was unanimously agreed that Congress have the power to prohibit slavery in the territories, and yet neither Crawford, Calhoun, nor Wirt could find any express power to that effect given in the Constitution. And Wirt declared himself very decidedly against the admission of any implied powers. The progress of this discussion has so totally merged in passion all the reasoning faculties of the slaveholders, that these gentlemen, in the simplicity of their hearts, had come to a conclusion in direct opposition to their premises, without being aware or conscious of inconsistency. They, the slaveholders, insisted upon it that the clause in the Constitution, which gives Congress power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and other property of the United States, had reference to it only as land, and conferred no authority to make rules binding upon its inhabitants. And Wirt added the notable Virginian objection that Congress could make only needful rules and regulations, and that a prohibition of slavery was not needful. Their argument, as Randolph said of it in the House, covered the whole ground, and their compromise, measured by their own principles, is a sacrifice of what they hold to be the Constitution. D. I had no doubt of the right of Congress to interdict or prohibit slavery in the territories, and urged that the power contained in the term dispose of included the authority to do everything that could be done with it as mere property, and that the additional words, authorizing needful rules and regulations respecting it, must have reference to persons connected or inhabitants with it, or could have no meaning at all. As to the force of the term needful, I observed, it was relative, and must always be supposed to have reference to some end. Needful to what end? Needful in the Constitution of the United States to any of the ends for which that compact was formed. Those ends are declared in its preamble. To establish justice, for example, what can be more needful for the establishment of justice than the interdiction or prohibition of slavery where it does not exist? E. As to the second question, my opinion was that the interdiction of slavery in the 8th section of the bill forever would apply and be binding upon the state as well as the territory, because by its interdiction in the territory, the people, when they come to form a constitution, would have no right to sanction slavery. F. Crawford said that in the new states which have been admitted into the Union upon the express condition that their constitutions should consist with the perpetual interdiction of slavery, slavery might be sanctioned by an ordinary act of their legislatures. G. I said that whatever a state legislature might do in point of fact, they could not, by any rightful exercise of power, establish slavery. The Declaration of Independence not only asserts the natural equality of all men and their inalienable right to liberty, but that the only just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. A power for one part of the people to make slaves of the other can never be derived from consent. and is therefore not a just power. H. After this meeting, I walked home with Calhoun, who said that the principles which I had avowed were just and noble, but that in the southern country, whenever they were mentioned, they were always understood as applying only to white men. Domestic labor was confined to the blacks, and such was the prejudice that if he, who was the most popular man in his district, were to keep a white servant in his house, his character and reputation would be irretrievably ruined. Page 13. I told Calhoun I could not see things in the same light. It is, in truth, all perverted sentiment mistaking labor for slavery and dominion for freedom. The discussion of this Missouri question has betrayed the secret of their souls. In the abstract, they admit that slavery is an evil. They disclaim all participation in the introduction of it, and cast it all upon the shoulders of our old grandam, Britain. But when probed to the quick upon it, they show at the bottom of their souls pride and vainglory in their condition of masterdom. They fancy themselves more generous and noble-hearted than the plain freemen who labor for subsistence. They look down upon the simplicity of a Yankee's manners, because he has no habits of overbearing like theirs, and cannot treat Negroes like dogs. It is among the evils of slavery that it taints the very sources of moral principle. It establishes false estimates of virtue and vice. For what can be more false and heartless than this doctrine which makes the first and holiest rights of humanity to depend upon the color of the skin? It perverts human reason. The impression produced upon my mind by the progress of this discussion is that the bargain between freedom and slavery contained in the Constitution of the United States is morally and politically vicious, inconsistent with the principles upon which alone our revolution can be justified. Cruel and oppressive, by riveting the chains of slavery, by pledging the faith of freedom to maintain and perpetuate the tyranny of the master, and grossly unequal and impolitic, by admitting that slaves are at once enemies to be kept in subjection, property to be secured or restored to their owners, and persons not to be represented themselves, but for whom their masters are privileged with nearly a double share of representation. The consequence has been that this slave representation has governed the Union. I have favored this Missouri Compromise, believing it to be all that could be effected under the present Constitution, and from extreme unwillingness to put the Union at hazard. But perhaps it would have been a wiser as well as a bolder course to have persisted in the restriction upon Missouri, till it should have terminated in a convention of the states to revise and amend the Constitution. This would have produced a new union of 13 or 14 states unpolluted with slavery, with a great and glorious object to effect, namely, that of rallying to their standard the other states by the universal emancipation of their slaves. If the union must be dissolved, slavery is precisely the question upon which it ought to break. For the present, however, this contest is laid asleep. Discussion questions on page 14. You may answer these questions in phrases. What key details do you see? Sub-questions. Do not answer all of these questions now. Let them guide your thoughts. Why is the meeting held between the president and his cabinet? What two questions did the meeting seek to answer? What did John Quincy Adams believe about the constitutionality of the Missouri Compromise? What did slaveholders argue about the constitutionality of the Missouri Compromise? How does the institution of slavery taint the American mind? Why does John Quincy Adams cite the Declaration of Independence? What does he foreshadow in the last line of his diary entry? This concludes the reading for Wednesday, April 1st.